This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Ewan McElraith from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. In this edition of the podcast, myself, Mark Stephen, and Ewan McElraith are going to continue our journey along Scotland's longest river, the Tay. We're going to start off in the fair city, Perth, about to visit an island in the middle of the river.
The most usual way across to the allotment is by a walkway, which is by the side of the rail bridge. But at low tide and low river levels, there's actually a causeway that you can drive across. It's a bit bumpy, and I would recommend a 4x4 vehicle.
This is Linda Leggett, and we're still actually on our trip down the River Tay. We're actually just standing in the city of Perth at the moment. I'm Mark Stephen. This is Out of Doors. As you can hear, we're not live from the car park. Also here, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, we made it to the Fair City, Scotland's newest city, actually, and we'd rather bizarrely head to an island here in the middle of Perth. Remember, we're not live, but you can email us, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Linda, is your husband John across the other side?
Yes, he is. They go, train.
So you actually, the walkway goes beside the railway line?
Yes, it does. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I've been across this bridge on a train, and I've often seen the allotments here. I honestly can't think of another group of allotments in Scotland that actually sit on an island.
I don't know of any more. I'm sure your listeners will probably be sort of emailing and saying, yes, we're on an island too, but we think we have a unique claim to fame that we are, yes, the only island allotments, but willing to be proved wrong.
How did the allotments come to be here?
They weren't always here. We've been here since, I think, about 1893. But before then, I believe the allotments were on the Dunkeld Road. And then, for some reason, we got moved and offered this land here, which we rent from Perth and Kinross Council. So, here we are.
Just to explain, we're walking across the pedestrian walkway beside the railway line, and we're actually walking across the river. And the river's really quite broad.
Yes, it is. Yes, And we have swans and all sorts of things in here. There's beavers, there's otters. Yeah.
So how do you get all this stuff onto the allotments?
We carry it.
Wheelbarrows.
Yes, and wheelbarrows. Lots of, if it's, you know, sort of compost and things like that, we actually wait until the river levels are low enough and some very kind person with a tractor and trailer brings it across for us.
Along that causeway you spoke about earlier.
Yes, yeah.
You're going underneath the bridge now.
We are. We're going under the railway bridge now. And welcome to Moncrieff Island. Yeah. And welcome to the allotment site on the island. So here we go. This is our walkway in. We have, as you can see, Sweet Cicely here. Uh-huh. And you'll smell it probably before you see it. Wild garlic.
You can smell the wild garlic.
Yeah. And we also have, I mean, they've just gone over, but lots and lots of daffodils here that have just finished flowering. So it's a lovely walk in, and I just think it's one of the most magical places on the planet. You know, you just sort of leave all the baggage of the world at the bottom of the steps there and just walk in.
And it says Perth Working Men's Garden Association.
Yes. Yes.
Have you had the discussion?
Yeah. Oh, yes, often.
Did it do any good?
No. I think that's the association's name, and yeah.
That's the history, really.
That's the history of it, yeah. Yeah. So in you go.
Thank you. Wow. This is huge.
It's a big setup, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Where's your allotment? Where's your one?
Where's my one? Right, come this way.
All very neat.
Thank you. Yes,
we are tidy, aren't we?
I'm not going to name names here, but I've been allotments, so I'm a bit of a mess.
We have got very, very, very keen and willing and happy allotmenteers now. And all plots are in working order right now. So lots are shared. This is a full plot here, which is...
It's a big one.
Yeah, 10 poles, apparently.
Wow. And a pole being?
Oh, no. Ask my husband, because I'm these archaic measurements.
Oh, right,
a quarter of a chain, isn't it?
So it's something. It's something.
He's
weird
making that up.
He might not be actually.
Yeah.
we have his and hers allotments. This is his.
Okay. So, your rhubarb's doing well, though.
Yes. Do you want some?
I've actually got rhubarb at home that I haven't touched yet. And what's the building here?
That's our pavilion.
Get out of here.
Come and see. It was gifted to the Allotment Association by, I think it was Lord Kincarathy.
Uh-huh.
And it's about 80 years old.
Yeah. It's a handsome building.
It is a very handsome building, yeah. And this is my other half with compost flung over his
Hello.
Shoulder.
Hello. Today, John's largely modelling a bag of compost.
Yeah. Compost look alike.
Yeah.
Settle an argument. What's a pole?
What's a pole?
Well, how long's a pole?
Oh, I'd hate to look it up, mate.
He lets me down. He lets me down. Yeah. Metric, what's the actual metric of a full plot?
A full plot size?
Yay.
It's 15 metres by 20 metres.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's quite a lot of ground to work.
It's a lot of ground to work, yeah. That's where we split it up into little beds.
Okay.
Much easier managed. That sort of thing, yeah.
Why do you, Pierre, have plots here?
Because we don't have a garden.
Ah.
and I mean, I started off not wanting a garden and then got really, 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 really into gardening because I met him. And both of our parents were very keen gardeners. And, yeah, here we are, allotmenteers.
Yeah, I always had a vegetable plot as a kid in the garden. My dad would give me a corner and I used to plant my own potatoes and carrots and things. It's always been with me, so... When we got here, we got a plot. And to save any arguments, we got one each. His and her plots.
Just looks idyllic, and you know, here you are on an island.
Yeah, it's. Do you want to have a quick look in the pavilion?
Yes, please.
So there we go. So the pavilion was gifted by A.K. Bell.
Uh-huh.
There we are.
Kincarathy House, opened by His Grace the Duke of Atholl.
In 1938.
Yeah.
So there we are.
Come on.
So it's been here all that time. So it's where we have our open day, which is the last Sunday in July, and people come and buy the produce that we grow on the island. So that helps sort of support us because we have to be sort of self-supporting. And as you can see, we've got a lot of perimeter fence to maintain, so we have to maintain that and obviously buy stocks of
a lot of
things.
Work. So have you got a waiting list?
Yes, we have.
How long?
There's about 40 on it at the moment. This is actually my plot, plot 35, on the island here. Growing all sorts, lots of fruit trees. We have apples and plums and pears. And we also have soft fruit. We have red currants, raspberries, a Tay berry, quite apt for being in the Tay or on it. Also black currants and gooseberries. And the obviously rhubarb and looking at some asparagus here. So I'm quite chuffed with my asparagus this year.
It's going well.
It is. It's quite young, so I'm quite happy with how it's going. And we grow all the usual suspects. We've got leeks and onions and beetroot and potatoes.
All the apple trees covered in blossom. It's just great.
Yeah, it's my little bit of heaven.
Linda Leggett and her little piece of heaven, and it's really hard to disagree with her. It's an absolute delight. Hidden away on this island. But there's more to this island, Moncrief Island, than just the allotments, because I've come along a wee bit to the King James VI Golf Club, which also shares the island. And I've come to meet some of the folk here, some of the members, some of the officials, to tell me more about the history of this amazing place and what it means to them.
My name's Ian McPhee, I'm the club manager, and we are currently at the King James VI Golf Club on Moncrief Island, Perth.
Dennis Brown, past captain.
Now, looking down the fairway here, it looks like a beautiful golf course. It's kind of a hidden gem.
I think one of our unique selling points for us here at the island is that I'm sure I'm right in saying that we're probably the only island golf course in the world that's in a city centre. So we have a really unique location here.
And you can't get cars onto here.
You can't get cars on. There is a causeway that you can get across at low tide certain times of the year, but not all the time. Other times, things have got to come across the bridge, and that's not exactly easy.
Everything?
In the middle of winter, the beer, everything's got to come across the bridge. So we've got to work out when we're going to want supplies. Things like sand, which we've had delivered over the last few weeks. You've got to plan 6-9 months in advance when you want to get deliveries of things that have got to come across the causeway. things like that.
So do you get a lot of volunteers for that?
Yeah, we've got a really accommodating greenkeeping team. You know, we've got three greenkeepers here, and they'll probably spend 40, 50% of their time off the course helping get supplies over.
Keeps them fit, though.
It does. A really fit team we have here. Yep.
Describe the course to me. It looks absolutely glorious at the moment.
I would probably describe it as a parkland course, 18 holes over 6,000 yards. You know, really popular, growing membership, like a lot of golf clubs at the moment. You know, we've got over 400 members, so in a good place at the moment.
Because it's a little gem, a little oasis in the middle of a city. It's hard to explain to you. You step onto the bridge, you walk across with the trains, and then you enter another world.
Well, I always remember one of the years when I was captain, and we had been following four American golfers, and they were sitting at the clubhouse, looking out the window there, and I went across to speak to them after they played, and the woman turned round to me and said, "You just don't know what you got."
Do you know what you got?
I think we take it for granted, though, what we have down here in terms of wildlife as well. You know, we've seen everything down here. We've got foxes, we've got deer, you know, and you can see it on any given day.
It didn't always look like this. How did it start? What was it?
Well, if you go back to the 1890s, the Caledonian Railway took down the old wooden bridge that went across for the railway and built the new bridge. And as part of building the new bridge, they decided to build a walkway on the side of it. And that allowed people to walk from Tay Street across to Barn Hill. After 5 years of negotiation with the town, the Allotment Association managed to get the top end of the island for allotments, and there were steps built down onto the island. That opened the door for King James VI Golf Club to shift from the North Inch down here, and the golf course was laid out by Tom Morris, and the course was opened in 1897.
But you were showing me photographs earlier on. There wasn't a tree on this island. This was a farm.
That's right. And another myth about the island as well. A lot of people talk about the island flooding and that. We rarely flood down here. Only when it comes over the banks does it flood. But we are it's a sand-based course, and the drainage is excellent.
When I joined back in 1969, you could look out the clubhouse and there was virtually not a tree here. And over the years, we've planted trees. One of the big things was in the middle 70s, when there was money being given for planting fir trees and that. We planted 1,000 fir trees on the course. And over the years, we've done lots of tree planting to make holes look better, to give segregation between different holes, and just to make the course look far better.
What about your age profile? There's quite a lot of clubs suffer from old manny syndrome.
Well, one of the things that's definitely happened is over the last 2 years, whereas COVID has sort of worked against a lot of things, COVID has actually worked for us, because our membership list has actually increased by over 100 in that period. But not only has it increased by 100, the age profile has dropped drastically.
Are people of Perth aware of what they've got here, or is it, as alluded to earlier on, a wee bit of a secret?
Yeah, I think the Perth public is very aware of what we've got here, and the only negative that gets thrown at the golf club is the lack of vehicle access, you know, because I honestly think if we had vehicle access here, you would really struggle to get a membership at King James. That's how popular the club is.
You say your numbers are increasing. Does that provide you with difficulties for storage, for lockers, where they keep their clubs?
We are in a lucky position that we have more lockers than we have members, and we could accommodate up to close on 700 people storing their clubs here. And obviously, if you want to play golf here, well, you don't want to carry your golf clubs back and forward. A few years ago, we actually bought a large porta cabin, and to actually get it onto the island, the lorry came to Tay Street, and then we tied loads of barrels round the actual porta cabin and lowered it into the river in a crane.
This has got disaster spillover.
Pulled it across with a winch on the tractor, and manoeuvred it into its position as you'd see as you came in this morning.
Just like one big raft race.
Well, almost.
Dennis and Ian from the King James VI Golf Club on the island over there. Because we've come the other side, back along the walkway.
Aye.
We're right down on the river's edge, behind the flood defences, and it's a delightful little oasis in the middle of the city.
I cannot work out why, because this is a slipway. You know, this is designed for big stuff to come down here, but the river gets deep very quickly, so I'm not sure what on earth you could do here.
I've no idea, unless you were, I don't know, maybe it was the construction of the bridge.
Maybe. It's a right bonny view down there, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, the traffic is literally 40, 50 metres away, just the other side of that wall. But we're looking down the bank here, and there's willows overhanging it. There's foam, there's dippers, that kind of thing. You know, it's a real rural scene.
It is.
How fantastic to have an island that size, though, in the centre of town. And in all honesty, for all the years we've been doing this, I've never been on that island before.
And how it survived the pressures of housing development is admirable to whoever protected it. It's great, but the river's so big.
Yeah. Oh, it's huge. And we're going to go out in it shortly because we've set up a canoe trip. Quite nice to actually get on the river at long last. Yeah. On to the canoes.
I'm David Marshall and I am the senior instructor here at Willowgate Activity Centre, and we're just going to be doing a nice little tour down from Perth City down to Elko Castle, and then we'll head back up to our centre here in Willowgate.
You're saying it just head up. There's a really strong wind. It's pretty flat. And the tide's going to be against us, is it?
The tide is going out at the moment. So, then
we've got the wind and the tide.
Yeah, so it's going to be quite a paddle.
Back upstream, yes.
And just how are we going to do this in terms of the canoes? You're going to tie these together?
Yes, because it's just the three of us going out with two boats. I'm just going to box tow, it's called, just a nice simple box tow to keep the boats together so that we can work together as a team. Three people are better than one.
Right, come on then. Let's get organised.
Okay, no. Right, I'll throw these together. I shouldn't take too long.
Okay. That's quite windy.
It's very windy. You know, and I think we'll get down to Elko Castle in about 3 seconds. And it'll take us about 30 minutes
to
get back up.
See, I naively thought we were going to get in the canoe, paddle down a bit, and
stop
then
for a picnic.
The rest of the production team would be waiting with a car. And he'd paddle back up in his own.
Why didn't we think
of that
earlier?
It just seems ridiculous, paddling back up against the current.
Hasn't even got an engine.
Yeah, I know.
See, I admire your ability to do that.
What?
Neil.
it's a quiet moment of prayer.
Yeah, we've got the two boats lashed together now, which is fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just a bit organised.
Yep.
We ready to go in the water?
Yep.
Yep. Perfect. I'll just come on that thing. Now a little bit. There we are. With my empty boat.
Ready?
Yep. Oh, you might feel a couple of jerks just as we settle in the water.
There it does. You are the steering and the motive power at the moment.
At the moment, yes.
It is unfortunate that it's as windy today as it is. But, I mean, how much does the character of this river actually change day to day?
From this point, quite a fair bit, actually, because it's tidal from the sea all the way up to Perth City. So Bridge End, the older bridge of the two bridges at Perth, is where it stops being tidal. Okay. And that changes every 6 hours. Because it constrains through the river, because it's so small, the tide changes quite drastically, quite quickly.
How popular is it for sport? Because there's absolutely loads of canoes and boats and
paddle boards
and children.
Yes, we at Willowgate are pretty busy. We've just started with the schools and things, so you see all the children running around at the moment. And this is our busy season started. So we have a lot of people coming and doing tours, just like this one we're doing, and other tours that we do. Just a little bit, 100 metres up there, there's a sailing club. And we will be passing a rowing club as well, which is just on the right hand side, as well as actually just up at the industrial estate at Perth City, there is a jet skiing club as well.
We're fairly scooting down the river you're steering, you're not paddling.
Yeah, that's just the flow. So the tide at the moment is low, so there's no tide at the sea, so it's all flow that we're getting at the moment. And as the Tay is the largest river in Scotland, it's quite a lot of water coming down, so it pushes us fair down quite a bit.
This is really quite a dramatic location because we're not terribly far away from the Fraton Bridge. You know, we're just basically downstream of it. Canoole Hill's off to our left with that Victorian folly up at the top of the cliffs. Because I go up and down that road a lot, something I wait for is for that hill greening up again every year.
Yeah, it's you definitely get a lot of different colours because there's a lot of variety of trees that's in there. You mentioned the tower as well. That's a little bit of an interesting because I've always thought it was a good story behind it, but it's quite simple. Someone fancied building a tower. It was never anything more than that.
They just fancied,
decided to build a tower on top of the hill.
And why not?
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know what it is about being in canoes, but you know, I'm doing nothing. I'm sitting here like Lord Muck.
No change there.
No change there. I know. As soon as I get onto the water, I just relax. There's something really calming about it.
Yes, absolutely. So it's something that I personally, even in my own time, not only at work, something I do a lot of is to relax and to wind down. So what I always say to customers and clients, people I teach, canoeing, if you are looking like you're working hard, you're doing it wrong. It needs to look fluid and smooth. Like you're dancing almost. It's
I very... must be doing it brilliantly then.
Must be, yes.
I notice, Mr. McElruth, you're not paddling at all.
Well, you don't need to paddle. We will be paddling later. We will be working hard coming back.
Tell you something else too that's just crossed my mind. Just further downstream there at Carpow, I was there when they dug the logboat out, you know, which was about 2,500 years old.
Yeah.
People have been doing this on this river for a long, long time.
Yes, yeah, a very long time. With the history of canoes, is that Canadian canoes, which is what we're in, is a mode of transport originally. It's for the Indigenous people of Canada to transport their goods. It's their highway. So old dugout canoes, much like you probably were mentioning, from silver birch trees, were just dug out the inside of a tree and used that to transport their goods. It's very much the same here, thousands of years.
It's also really good with the wildlife. It's not the most exciting wildlife, but there's a pile of gulls, a couple of jackdaws there, completely unfazed black-headed gull, because you're in a canoe.
I think what a lot of the thing with the wildlife these days is they're almost so attuned to us being around. There is quite a bit more wildlife that obviously don't like our presence as much. Like beavers are on the river now. They've been introduced to the river. And they only come out at dusk and dawn because of the quietness and the ability to work.
You got beaver around here?
Yes, there's a couple of spots where the beavers are at Willowgate. There's quite a lot of evidence up by the cafe that's up just up there across from Moncrief Island, where they've chewed down quite a lot of the trees, and there's some beaver slides as well, because quite big banks down there. So the evidence is there. But
so that if it's across from Moncrief Island, basically the beaver are more or less in the heart of Perth.
More or less, yes. Yes,
that's brilliant.
Yes, more or less, yes.
Why do I have the feeling that tomorrow that right shoulder of mine is just going to be an absolute agony?
And tomorrow this is going to be flat, calm and no wind at all.
No.
That was great getting out of the river. And we're at the water sports centre. Children everywhere here, on canoes, in canoes, paddle boards, and just taken to the water with screams of delight.
Yeah.
Just like us.
Yeah, well, we are pretty well. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElruth. As you can probably tell, we're not live this week, but if you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yep, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the podcast. You can email us where at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Right, we're going to split up now. You're going one side of the river,
I'm going to the north, you're going in the south. I'm going to learn, get a bit of insight into one of Scotland's greatest poets, McGonagall.
I'm not sure about greatest, but certainly best known
poets.
Well,
apparently he was really good.
Uh-huh.
Almost better than me.
You've got exalted standards. You're going off for poetry.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and find the oldest whiskey still in Scotland. See ya. I think I win.
My name's Drew Mackenzie Smith. I'm the founder and managing director of Lindores Abbey Distillery, but I'm also lucky enough to be the custodian for the time being of Lindores Abbey.
I've never actually been here before.
Well, my great-grandfather bought the Abbey in 1913. Well, I say he bought the Abbey, he bought Lindores Abbey Farm, and the Abbey was just in the middle of it. And I think because it's sort of been in private hands, very few people, even a lot of people in Fife, don't know it exists. They maybe do more so now because of the distillery. And the funny thing is, the distillery wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the history of the Abbey and Friar John Corr. But actually, there's a lot of things that have happened here over the centuries that arguably, in fact definitely, are far more important than just the whisky link. You know, we've had William Wallace here after the Battle of Black Ironside. You had Prince Alexander died here. First Duke of Rothesay's buried here. So there's a big history that... Part of my role, if you like, is to get more people to know about the history beyond whisky.
I hadn't realised that there was a connection here with Father Corr. Because, I mean, that's basically the earliest record of whisky making in Scotland, isn't it?
It is. I mean, that, as I say, the distillery wouldn't be here without that. So the Exchequer role still exists. It's sitting in Edinburgh, and I've had the privilege of actually seeing it, and it's about 30 yards long, and it's all the royal...
It's literally a roll. It's like it a roll of wallpaper, more or less.
Exactly, and it's the financial transactions of the king, and it sort of starts off in the high, and each bit separate, etc., and in the middle of the Fife section, barely legible, you know, because it's in Latin and it's several hundred years old, but buried in amongst that, there's one bit, and it's a to Friar John Corr, 8 bowls of malt wherewith to make aqua vitae for the king. And that's the earliest written reference. Oddly enough, the second one is 1496, and it's the Guild of Surgeon Barbers. And I suppose, like everything in life, if it was the other way around, there wouldn't be a distillery here because it would be the second entry. And that's just the way the world is.
This is a bit like a secret garden. It's a really beautiful wee place. The abbey itself was built of red sandstone. And some of the walls are still standing. But, of course, most of this was dinged down in the Reformation.
Sadly, it was. I think what happened... I mean, John Knox and his followers actually physically came here and threw out the monks and rid them of their monkish habits. I think history says also that a lot of the monks stayed in the area because they quite liked it. So they didn't necessarily just all disappear. And I think over time it got ransacked. And tragically, there's very little left of Lindores. I mean, not just a physical building, but there's no pictures or anything like that. Well, I mean, luckily we have recreated the best guess of what it looked like. But so, yeah, sadly, then it became a quarry. And for centuries it was just known as the Wilderness because it was just completely overgrown. You know, which is a shame. And one of the great things when we built the distillery is we had to do some archaeology just to make sure we weren't doing anything we shouldn't be doing or building on graveyards and things like that. And over the road from here, we always thought that was the agricultural side and this was the monastic side because there's a great big barn wall. But when we did the archaeology, we started finding all these other walls over that side of the road, which gave us the footprint of the abbey sort of for the first time in centuries, which allowed us to create this best vision of what it actually looked like. But it also was kind of nice because it means the distillery actually is sitting in the middle of the abbey rather than just over the road from it.
As I understand it, the archaeologists also found what may potentially be the oldest whisky still in Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, Lindore, it's a funny thing, it's a sort of gift that keeps on giving because we'd finished with these walls because we dug the trenches, found the walls, that gave us a footprint. But then, quite rightly, we had to record every single piece and then fill them with sand, and they're hopefully preserved for another 500 years. So we'd finished all that. The last bit of work we really need to do, which you'd do on any project, is put a suds pond in. Not very glamorous, but you have
what's,
to
have, what's a suds pond?
A suds pond is really just a drainage pond. You'll see it on any sort of new building site, and it's really just to collect water.
Cat sediment and things.
Yeah, exactly. So it's nothing to do with whisky. It's nothing sort of glamorous, but it's a necessity. So again, we thought, well, okay, now we know where all these walls are. There's a blank bit there. Let's get the digger in and do that. So that's what we did, and then Rebecca, our archaeologist, came across very, very excited. because we thought we'd found a medieval well. It was a circle of red sandstone, the same stone that the abbey's built from, and it was full of water. And we thought, well, that's, you know, that's a great thing to find. But then we carefully took the water out, and it's a clay-lined bowl, okay, which we've had flot tested, and don't ask me what flot stands for, I can't remember, but it's a scientific test, and what we discovered was traces of carbon and wood and barley. And so the experts believe it to be a medieval still, so to find that at Lindores was like the Holy Grail. Now, the trouble is, you can never prove it. You can never absolutely prove it. There's not going to be a scroll with a monk in 1494 printed on it. So, and funny enough, speaking to a politician friend of mine, I said, well, you guys are good at sort of spinning things. How do we say this? And what I was advised to say is that we believe it to be, because no one will ever know 100%. Yeah. But if you think you've got barley, you've got carbon, you've got history of distilling. So for me, it's the Holy Grail. It's one of these things that very few people know about it because it's just a wee small abbey in a quiet bit of Fife.
Drew Mackenzie Smith at Lindores Abbey there. As I said, I've never been there before. It is a ruin, but there's just something about it. It's got atmosphere about it. It's really quite remarkable. As I said, I'm here at Lindores, which is halfway along the Tay, essentially, but Ewan's made it all the way to Dundee, where he's having a poetic day by the Silvery Tay.
My name is Jennifer Barnes, and I'm a lecturer at the University of Dundee, and I'm very interested in William McGonagall and Dundee. And we are currently sitting in Magdalen Green, which features frequently in McGonagall's poetry. We are sitting just at the bottom of Patton's Lane, where McGonagall lived for 30 years, and just a couple of streets down is the Seafield Works, where McGonagall was employed as a handloom weaver. From all of these spaces, you can see the Silvery Tay, as McGonagall famously referred to it.
McGonagall is one of these guys, well, I'm going to put it bluntly, people think of him as a bit of a joke, but he was a fascinating character.
He really was, and I don't think of him as a bit of a joke at all. In fact, I think of him as a very creative genius, if you like, rather than a heroic failure, as he's been previously described. And I think we understand him a bit more if we think about the way that his career as a poet is connected to his career as an actor prior to his move into poetry. And I think if we understand that, we understand McGonagall and his genius a little bit more.
I thought he wasn't a particularly great actor, am I wrong?
He was a terrible actor, and I think that's kind of the point. He apparently yelled rather than recited, and there's a brilliant story about McGonagall being invited by the manager of the Theatre Royal to come and perform two scenes from Macbeth in 1858. And McGonagall goes along, and he was particularly, and this shows how famous he was as a local actor and how popular he was at the time, but he goes along and he is performing the final scene where Macbeth and Macduff have a duel and Macbeth is killed. And McGonagall at this point, he's known for his great prowess in fighting on stage. So he starts fighting with Macduff at the end of the play. And Macduff, McGonagall feels, tries to cut his performance short, stabs him too soon. McGonagall is not happy about this. He believes the actor might be jealous of his great fighting skills. And so, although he has been thoroughly run through with Macduff's sword, he just refuses to die. Contemporary reports talk about him waving his sword about his ears and the audience worrying that the performance is going to end in real tragedy. Macduff is heard audibly yelling over the sound of the crowd for McGonagall to go down, go down. And McGonagall is only sent down when Macduff trips him up and pulls his feet from under him and brings the performance to a close. But McGonagall afterwards very vocally talks about how he felt he acted splendidly in that performance. And McGonagall's sense of his own brilliance and his failure to achieve that brilliance on stage is really part of what's enjoyable for local audiences about his performance. And that's what they expect of McGonagall. The reason I wanted to talk about Patton's Lane is that it's in Patton's Lane that McGonagall makes the decision to become a poet. And in his autobiography, he talks about this in a really interesting way. He says that he was in his living room in June. It was a balmy day like this in 1877. And he imagines that he sees a pen appear in his hand and a disembodied voice call to him and say, write, write.
Well, that's a good start.
It is a really good start. And the interesting thing for me about that is that this, I believe, is an appropriation of Macbeth. So the kind of phantom pen mimics the phantom dagger of the play and the disembodied voice. It all comes from Macbeth. And Dundee had a rich theatrical culture in the mid-19th century that I think is overlooked. There was loads of amateur dramatics going on that McGonagall was heavily involved in. Penny booths, music halls, grand theatres at Yeoman Shaw and on Castle Street, the Theatre Royal. In the 1870s, when McGonagall turns to poetry, there is an industrial decline. Weaving is not going so well. And there's also, at that point, a trend for bad verse that is pushed through the local press. And McGonagall really takes advantage of that trend. He connects it with his local fame as a bad actor and becomes a bad poet.
Beautiful railway bridge of the silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time.
Was he any good? I like it, and I don't quite get why people just dismiss him.
I think that McGonagall's poetry is brilliant. It's brilliantly comic, and I think that it reflects his wider genius for performance.
Oh, ill-fated bridge of the silvery Tay, I must now conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly, without the least dismay, that your central girders would not have given way, at least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side with buttresses. At least many sensible men confesses. For the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed.
Could you describe him as an entertainer then?
Absolutely, he was an entertainer. He was an all-rounder. It's best, I think, to think of him as a performance poet. His work crosses all kinds of different modes of performance: poetry, music, journalism. He's more than the sum of his parts, and to just consider him as a failed poet is to only see a very small part of McGonagall's performance. I think that he was an artist, and this is something that we should be focusing on and exploring more, and contextualising McGonagall, placing him in Dundee in the mid-19th century.
But Dundee seems to have forgotten about him, or actually just shoved him in a corner.
McGonagall brilliantly managed to collapse his performance in print and on stage with his personal life. And in Dundee, he suffered greatly. He talked about not being able to leave his house without being pestered and laughed at. The performances that he gave from the 1870s onwards started to become very violent. You know, there's that famous story about him being constantly pelted with peas and eggs and flour. And McGonagall left Dundee for Edinburgh under that cloud. And I think in Dundee, we need to revisit McGonagall and embrace him again and welcome him back to Dundee. I'm working on a project at the University of Dundee at the moment that is going to rethink and celebrate McGonagall not as a heroic failure but as an artist.
And mock McGonagall at your peril.
Mock McGonagall at your peril, but McGonagall kind of invited that mocking, and I think that the fact that we don't always recognise that is part of his genius.
Dr. Jane Barnes from the University of Dundee, and raising McGonagall from a figure of ridicule to a man of absolute genius. I'm a big fan of McGonagall now, the actor, the poet, and the man. Dundee should be more aware of what they've got. Now, I'm on the north side of the river. Meanwhile, Mark is over the river, indulging in his favourite pastime, talking about planes.
These laburnum trees were planted in July 1944 to commemorate the visits of King Haakon VII of Norway to No. 333 Squadron Royal Norwegian Air Force, which was based at Woodhaven during World War II.
That's David Winch, who's an ex-commodore of the Wormwood Sailing Club, and
Evelyn Hardy actually belongs to a place called Sandford House. Why was there a Norwegian squadron here, and what of?
They were Catalina flying boats. The reason they were here was that there had in the past, in the 1930s, been some activity involving flying boats, and it was also a nice secret spot and suitable for the Catalinas to undertake clandestine missions to land agents on the coast of Norway to observe German movements.
How big was the squadron here? How many planes?
There were altogether three at any one time. These were replaced from time to time due to wear and tear, and one was actually lost on an operation, and that resulted in the only fatality from the squadron that was based here. There was another flight, B flight, which flew Mosquitoes from Lucas, who later became 334 Squadron, having been part of the Banff flight wing, which attacked the Germans at the very end of the war in the fjords.
Yes. And what's the connection with Sandford House and the Norwegians?
Well, Sandford House was where Lady Bluebell Walker and Sir William Walker lived during the war.
Was that her name, Bluebell Walker?
Lady Bluebell Walker, yes.
Oh, I love it.
And she looked after the Norwegians, basically, when they were on their leave period. So they would come up to Sandford House, maybe for 1 or 2 weeks at a time, and she would basically let them stay there, feed them, look after them, let them borrow her motorbike to take their girls out on jaunts in the countryside, and basically just to give them a rest.
Yeah. Was there, fraternisation's the wrong word because they were on our side, but they must have got on well with the locals and the Norwegians.
They did very well indeed. All the people you speak to who remember them say how polite they were and how friendly and what nice boys they were. They went to the local tennis club and met the girls, of course, and they played football in the fields behind here, and they had a sports day one day, tug of war and that sort of thing between the locals. Some of them were billeted with local people.
We're talking nearly 80 years ago. How have you kept that connection alive?
It's come about because one of the veterans who actually served here started as a gunner, a rear gunner, Egil Johansson, and he retired as a lieutenant colonel. He particularly made friends with people here, and in the early 1970s, he decided to make contact again. At the same time, Wormit Boating Club moved from further up the river to this site, and David Owen, who was the treasurer of the club at the time, was also making research as to what had happened during the war. The two made friends, and the result was a long, lifelong friendship between them, but also the stone which we've just read the legend from was presented in 1974 by the veterans to the area, and the boat club has adopted.
I saw you cleaning it earlier.
Yes.
But that's a nice human touch, I think.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. And Sandford House, have any of the Norwegians actually come and stayed there since the war?
I don't think they've actually come and stayed, but they have been a few times to visit. The present-day 333 Squadron basically come every year and do a visit where they come here, then they visit Lookers, and they go up to RAF Lossiemouth, I think, up that way as well. And they always include Sandford as part of their tour, basically, because, you know, it's part of the history of the squadron. There's a laburnum tree here, which the story behind that is that they planted, was it two trees that were planted, I think, and one of them came to grief and blew down in a storm, and this one's not looking too great at the moment, but it's still there. And local woodturners took bits of the tree and actually turned it into, you know, items, basically bowls and
The tree fell 60 years after it had been planted, we said to the woodturners, bring your chainsaws, take away the wood for your own purposes, on one condition, that you'll make something that we can send to Norway. And they did that, and there are lots of pen sets, bowls, gavels, and artefacts that have been given as gifts to the Norwegians when they visited.
Tell me about Willie Rankin.
Willie Rankin had a joiners and undertakers business in the building that you see here. And when the Norwegians took over the base, his house was actually enclosed within the confines of the base. So he was allowed to become part of them. And over the war, he made friends with them all. And at the end of the war, he started a tradition of raising the Norwegian flag on the King's birthday and on their national day, May the 17th. That tradition still continues today.
I'm a great fan of these stones because, you know, you stand here in the River Tay, walk past, come down to the boat club. Without something like that, you have no idea there's this depth of history.
That's correct, yes. And the very nice thing is that it's being kept alive. Woodhaven has become almost iconic, certainly for 333 Squadron, because when the serving members come, they come to see the birthplace of their squadron, and they're very proud of being able to do that. And also the Royal Norwegian Air Force, similarly, has a place for it in their thoughts and their hearts.
David Winch and Evelyn Hardy at the site of the old 333 Squadron.
So this was seaplanes?
Seaplanes here. But I've just noticed that there's actually another memorial just round the corner to the boys of the Mars training ship.
Yeah, the Mars training ship was... I mean, the Navy did it a lot. They took ships from the 1840s, big warships, and they anchored them round the country. Some as training vessels for sea cadets, but the Mars was anchored here from about 1860 and stayed here till about 1930. And it could take 400 boys, disadvantaged boys, and train them to become masons or farmers or shipwrights and turn them into useful members of society. It was a national institution.
Sadly, part of being a useful member of society was going to war. So on one face of that memorial, it commemorates those lost in the First World War. On the other side, the memorial is the Second World War. Just listen to that behind me, Phil. You know, we started off, you know, on this journey down the River Tay at Killin, the far end of, you know, Loch Tay. Flat calm, quiet as you like. It can get quite rough, this.
It is rough. It was beginning to get rough when we were out on the canoe. It's a lot rougher here. But you just get a sense of the magnitude of this river.
Yeah. We're going to go further along the bank of the river here. Hopefully, we'll be able to get out in the boat and meet up.
Maybe.
Well, maybe no, don't know. Meet up with a hydrologist, because what we were arguing about last night, where does the river stop and the Firth actually begin?
We get an answer.
We need a grown-up for that. Yeah, I cannot remember the last time that I actually entered a place where there's so much stuff that I thought, ooh.
There's hundreds of outboard engines here. In fact, there's lots of everything.
There's pipes, there's ropes, there's old bits of... I mean, everything you look at, you think, what is this? This is David Anderson's boatyard, which is, you know, down in Newport. On the River Tay.
And it's the old ferry terminal for Dundee. Because you've got this lovely remains of Victorian buildings behind us.
Yeah.
And these things were dotted all along the coast to serve the folk of Dundee.
Yeah. We're going to go out in this boat. They've decided that the wind's died enough that we can actually get out, head down. We're taking a hydrologist with us.
Everyone should have a hydrologist.
Yeah, always. I'd never leave home without one.
My name's Paul Anderson, and we're on a cabin drib on the River Tay.
It was a bit too rough this morning, but it's okay now.
That's all right. Well, it's still a little bit choppy, but we're going to go out and see how we get on today.
And you've got two huge engines at the back.
That's right, yeah. We've got 600 horsepower back there, two outboard engines, 300 horsepower each. Get up to a speed of about 50 knots.
So 50 knots? So we'll be able to carve through this very easily.
That's right, we'll be bouncing from one wave to the next, that's for sure.
Missing out four in between, yeah.
But you're starting tours up again. People can get out on the river.
That's right, yeah. Just this summer we're starting again after a couple of years of having to put them on hold. So as the summer months start to come in, we'll surely get busy with people wanting to get out and enjoy the weather.
The only downside of that is, you know, the regulations, the restrictions with COVID are obviously relaxing. But the cost of marine diesel's going through the roof.
Yeah, it's something that we're keeping an eye on. It's just getting so much more and more every day that we're just going to have to see how we get on.
Just passed underneath the road bridge across the Tay, and we've been touting the fact that we have a hydrologist aboard, Dr. Andrew Black from Dundee University. You want to ask the question?
You're going to tell us where the river ends, because you've been following the river from the start to the end. I'm no hydrologist, but presumably you just dip your finger in the water, and when it stops being fresh and starts being salty, that's the end.
You think I should stick my finger in the water? I normally sit at a desk and use a computer these days. So you can tell the hesitation suggests it's not that easy a question. So sometimes people will look at the limits of the tides. So if there is no tidal influence, then there's the bottom of your freshwater river. But I think, in fact, the question depends on who wants to know and why. So if we're trying to learn about theory, then we might take one approach, but often hydrologists are actually involved in problem solving. What's the risk of flooding? How much might it increase as a result of climate change? How much water is there going to be available in a drought situation? So hydrologists will address questions in a practical way.
Earlier on this trip, we were actually in the centre of Perth, which has extensive, albeit rather beautifully disguised, flood defences. Why? Why does this area flood with such monotonous regularity?
I don't know about your regularity, but it certainly does big floods. So in the last 200 years, the biggest flood that's been known in the British Isles was the flood of 1993 on the Tay, and that was a result of major snowmelt and a lot of rainfall from frontal rain systems as well. It's a big catchment, and ordinarily, if we just look at the mean flow, the average flow of the River Tay, that river has a bigger flow than any other river in the UK. Now, that doesn't tell us much about the record floods. And remember, of course, that the River Channel is wide at Perth, so it actually has a huge ability to discharge water without it getting into people's homes and businesses and so forth. But when conditions conspire to combine huge amounts of runoff from rainfall and snowmelt, then the extremes can be high. So it's 2,268 cubic metres a second passed down the Tay for a brief moment on the 17th of January 1993, and that is still a UK record.
What changes are you seeing in terms of climate change?
Year to year, the behaviour of this river is erratic. It's very difficult to expect climate change to be showing readily identifiable patterns. No 2 years are the same. We have had some extreme highs with the floods of the 1990s and some more recently. We have had some very dry period. 2018 was dry. There's already a water resources situation developing this year where we might end up in a bit of difficulty. I think the biggest thing looking forward is uncertainty. You know, no matter how much money you pay researchers, nobody is going to give a cast iron guarantee this is what's going to happen over the next 30, 50, 100 years. Uncertainty is definitely on the rise because we're dealing with a system that's going to behave in ways that none of us has ever seen before. And that's something that's going to keep hydrologists like me busy for plenty of years to come.
Okay, yeah, we're just approaching Tayport Harbour here with the Larwick Beacon just in front of us. And if we look over to our left, which is the port side of the boat, we can see Broughty Ferry Castle. I think it's about just over one half of a nautical mile between the land here.
That's Tensmere Forest, just directly in front of us, more or less.
Yeah, you can see the size of Tensmere Forest from here, how wide and vast it is. It's an amazing forest.
Apparently, I couldn't swear to it, but I think that's one of the few areas in the UK that's actually growing rather than eroding.
My only source of knowledge in this is an interview that you did. So I'm going to take your word for it. But it's such an eerie contrast. You've got the nature reserve there,
yeah.
Beautiful wee harbours, and then oil rigs and jackets for wind turbines on the other. It's just constant contrast.
Yeah.
and the V&A behind.
Yeah, it's actually my favourite view of the V&A is when you're right alongside it by boat. You can really appreciate the structure of it and see the shape of what actually looks like the bow of a boat at one corner of it, which you can't really see from the land.
Yeah. We've got a lovely gaff-rigged sailing boat with brown sails, traditional no engine, beating up against the wind.
It's doing well.
She's a better man than me. What do you get in the way of wildlife here?
Oh, an incredible amount of stuff. Probably most impressively, the bottlenose dolphin pods that swim up here most summers. We'll get porpoises, puffins, guillemots, just an incredible amount of birds and fish as well. People don't believe you when you tell them that you've seen dolphins today when you've been out on the boat in the day. They don't believe it until they see it. It's a great part of the world. I do love living here.
So, coming back to our original question, where does the river stop and where does the Firth begin?
The tidal limit is just above Perth. It's close to the confluence with the Armond, so that's where I would put the end of the freshwater Tay and the start of the estuary.
So the vast majority of today, we've actually been on the Firth of Tay and not the River Tay.
It sounds like it.
Nobody told us. There's a way round this. I can't quite think what it is yet.
Yes. Well, that's the programme's thanks. You've just shot the programme clean out of the water.
Would you like a retake on that?
No, we'll stick with the truth.
We're following the Tay from the top to the end of the estuary.
So actually, it's all part of the world's water. It's always beside us. We can never escape it. Even in the driest of deserts, there's always water there.
So we can never end this programme.
I've had that feeling before. I actually think this trip has been fascinating for a whole variety of reasons.
Yeah,
there's so much history here and stuff to see, and you know, there's a lot of wildlife.
It's very different from part one.
Yes.
When the river was much smaller. And it's nice to be able to get out into the estuary now and get a very different feel for it. But you do get that sensation of how big it is, how long it is, the power of it. It's quite a river.
Quite a river, and we'd just like to thank everybody that's helped us, you know, on this trip. Dr. Andrew Black, who's kind of shot the entire premise of the programme out from underneath us, but never mind. That's what science does. Deep down.
Science and what we do, it just never mix.
From all of the TV at BBC Aberdeen, myself, from Ewan, from Laura and from Fiona, thank you very much for listening.
And that's us. At long last, we've completed our journey to the mouth of the River Tay. And it's been a splendid trip. There's been some fascinating stuff along the way. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. This has been the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Until the next time, thanks for listening.